Today we arrive at the most famous portion of the book of Esther. If you knew only one segment of this narrative before this study, Mordecai's eloquent appeal to Esther for such a time as this was probably it. The segment is so vital to the narrative that now we view it in context and see what other riches God has hidden there for us. There were perhaps 15 million Jews scattered throughout the Persian Empire. And by the time we get to this point in the story, Haman had convinced the easily convincible Xerxes to destroy all the Jews. The dice had been cast. The date had been set. The decree had gone to all corners of Persia. Mordecai got word of the impending Holocaust and abandoned all pretense. Esther chapter 4 verses 1 and 2. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the city wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. News of the extermination decree drove Mordecai into a state of anguish. He wardrobed himself in coarse cloth and smeared his face with soot and ashes. He donned the garb of a funeral dirge, and he roamed the streets of Susa, crying and wailing and screaming and beating his chest. Officials stopped and stared. Store owners turned and watched. What a spectacle. Remember, he was known for his importance to the queen, a courtier in the gate. Yet Mordecai breached all decorum. And Esther got word of his wailing and was aghast that he would behave in such a manner. So she sent him a batch of clothing and told him in no uncertain terms to quit throwing such a fit. And he was jeopardizing everything that two of them had put into place. They had won favor with the king. They had won respect in the citadel. And apparently she was unaware of the decree, an indication of just how cloistered she was from public life. So what followed was a series of courtiered messages between the two. Mordecai sent Esther a copy of the extermination orders and urged her to reach out to her husband, the king. But a queen just can't saunter into the throne room, she reminded Mordecai. If she showed up uninvited, a cranky king could have her head. Verse 11, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces knew that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned by the king has but one law, that they be put to death, unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Can't we envision Esther ticking off on her fingers all of the reasons to stay silent? It's against the law. It's been 30 days since he gave me so much as a second look. The king's in a foul mood for sure. He'll probably kill me. You remember Vashti? Mordecai gave her reservations some thoughts, but then sent a message. Max Lucado, before we read his words, can I tee them up? They are some of the most profound observations you will read in the Bible. What he said in two verses is worth two volumes of consideration. Mordecai the Jew became Mordecai the theologian. He made a declaration that reveals the heart of a person who has encountered the heart of a holy God. You're about to hear one of the greatest one-paragraph calls to courage ever spoken by a human tongue. See if you don't agree. Verses 13 and 14 of chapter 4. Do you think that because you're in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape? For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. Beth Moore. To what surely was her surprise, Esther received such a strong and pointed response from Mordecai that we have to have respect for Hatak, the courtier, who having the courage to even deliver it. And since Mordecai could not see Esther face to face, he intended his words to be like firm hands on her shoulder, shaking her the passivity out of her. Max, how do we survive the bitterly cold winds of life? When the downsizing has been declared, when the pandemic has no vaccine, when the account has no cash, when the marriage has no joy, when the crib is empty or the grave is occupied or the double bed is down to you and you can't quit crying yourself to sleep? What circumstances leave you desperate and feeling all alone in a wintry ditch? Might Mordecai's words be worth the retelling? He made a duo of starchy observations. First, no one gets a free pass, not even the Queen of Persia. Do you think that because you are the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will accept? Don't think for a second, Esther, that you'll get through this genocide unscathed. The fact that the Jews will be saved in no way assures you and the good name of your family will survive. Your legacy will be sacrificed on the altar of apathy. You might dodge the first bullet, but there are five more in the clip. Trouble knocks at the door of us all. Well, thanks, Max. You call that good news? I thought you were going to give us some hope to get me through this tough time. Maybe you don't need the reminder, but someone does. Someone has been led to believe that Christians walk down a yellow brick road and a trip home to Kansas is only a click away. Consequently, when the inevitable bad stuff does happen, the person is forced to face not just the bad stuff, but also has tough questions about a God who supposedly didn't keep his promises. To which God says, I never made those promises for an easy, soft life. Here's what God said. John 16:33, in this world you will have trouble. 2 Corinthians 1:9, you will at times feel as though you've received the sentence of death. Isaiah 43:3, you will pass through the waters, pass through the rivers, walk through the fire. Trouble comes with life. We gain nothing by pretending that it doesn't. No one gets a free pass. But secondly, one way or another, relief and deliverance will come. In the beginning of chapter 4, we see Mordecai lamenting in the streets, expecting disaster. When he learned of the order to kill all the Jews, as you saw, he tore his clothes and put on sackcloth and ashes and went out into the city wailing and crying bitterly. This was a ferocious image, a tearing of his threads, his throat screaming, the garments torn, flesh exposed. To tear clothing was to declare outwardly what was happening inwardly. Mordecai was torn up inside, and to be certain, he was desperate. 13 verses later, though, he makes an abundant face, and he about face. And he tells Esther, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews. Well, what happened to him? What made this change from desperate to bold? Max again. Here's my best guess. God awakened a suppressed belief in Mordecai. On Mordecai's mama's knee, He'd been told how Moses and a million Hebrews had an angry sea on one side and an angry Pharaoh on the other. How a shepherd boy stood waist high with a Goliath of a giant. How Daniel could hear the growling of the lions and the growling of their stomachs. But then God spoke up. The seas opened up. David rose up. The lions shut up. And it dawned on Mordecai that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob was alive and well and undefeated in battle. The Jews were far from Jerusalem, but they were not far from God. Mordecai may have neglected his role as a curator of the covenant, but God had not forsaken his role as a covenant keeper. God's heart was still attached to the Jews, his people, a remnant carried away from Zion and now living in exile in Persia. The Jews had no king, no army, no temple, no priesthood, no sacrifices. No matter. They still had their Jehovah. Not once was God threatened or undone or bewildered or befuddled. God is to problems what a hurricane is to a mosquito. No match. Mordecai got this. Do you? Do I? Do we get this? Do you know the rest of those verses? I'm sure you do. In this world, you will have trouble. But take heart, declared Jesus. I have overcome the world. Indeed, we felt that we had received the sentence of death, but that was to make us rely not on ourselves, but on God who raises the dead, 2 Corinthians 1:9. Yes, the journey includes waters and fires and rivers, but when you pass through the waters, I will be with you. And through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. And when you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame will not consume you. Diane has one more procedure, a treatment on Tuesday in the radiation therapy. And she found this verse, Psalm 144, verse 2, and personalized it as she goes through. You are my shelter of love and my fortress of faith. You wrap yourself around me as a secure shield. I hide myself in you. What a beautiful promise. Does your view of God include a certain relief, a dramatic deliverance? That's no small question. As Lynn went through her procedure, God was with her, a surrounding shield. The vast majority of people actually see no pending relief. Their summary of life reads like a Shakespearean tragedy. We live in a beautiful but broken world. It can't be fixed. Nothing can be done. So let's just make the best of it and then die. For many people, that's life in a nutshell. So it's hardly any surprise that we live in a day of despair and rising suicide. But the story God offers, by comparison, is a golden meadow. It begins like the other, but it ends in a far better place. Let me read from Made for This Moment. Quote, "We live in a beautiful world, but broken. However, our Creator made this world and did not destine it or us for brokenness. He destined it for a wonderful life. His intentions for us are good. He cares so much for us that he became one of us. He took on our brokenness even to the point of death. His death gave birth to our life, eternal life. He arose from the dead and is recreating our world, and he invites all to be a part of it. One day he will restore the world to its intended beauty, reclaim his family, and we will live with him forever. And that's the message of Mordecai. Relief is coming. And so he says to Esther, who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this? Esther's response was significant. Verse 16. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. And when this fast is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. You just heard the turning point in the development of our main character. The faith of Hadassah merges with the authority of the crown, and she commands Mordecai in the imperative to assemble the Jews for a public fast. In doing so, she assumes the role of the moral leader for her people, and her resolve replaces her passivity. Yes, she's no longer the beauty queen. She's a woman of God, determined to lead her people through a crisis. What happened? What moved Esther from "I can't do anything" to "I'm willing to lose everything"? What took her from "if I go, I'll perish" to "if I perish, I perish"? It had to be the straightforward message of Mordecai. Yes, the world is a mess. Yes, we have fallen victim to a brutal Haman. But relief will come, and who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. Mordecai opened a window and shed divine light into Esther's world. You are here for a reason. Your life is part of a plan. And that's what I told the kids at Grace Christian School this last week. You were placed here for a purpose. On purpose. For a purpose. Beth Moore. None of our purposes will be fulfilled easily. All of them will require difficult decisions. Decisions that we may feel will even practically kill us. Then God does something miraculous and we become something we're not. That's when who knows becomes I know. At some of the hardest times in my life, I have been able to make the most difficult choice out of pure, blind-eyed, bent-kneed acceptance that it is somehow part of a greater plan. I was beaten by a conviction that throbbed relentlessly against my strong self-centeredness. As much as my flesh wanted relief, I knew that when all was said and done, I'd sit on that side of glory, having much rather fulfilled my calling than to have served myself all the way to meaninglessness. I have to accept that I was not called to an easy life. I was called to a purposeful life. And you were too, my friend. You, like Esther, were made for this moment. To be clear, you didn't ask for this struggle. You want to get past it. You don't know how much longer perhaps you can hold up. But what if God is in this? Did he not place you on this planet, in this generation? He determined your birth date. Today's was Diana's in 1946. He determined your nationality. He selected your neighborhood. Acts 17:26. And what if you, like Esther, have an opportunity to act in a way that will bless more people than you can possibly imagine? This is your hour. This is your moment. You were made to stand up like Mordecai, to speak up like Esther. Deliverance will come. God will have his victory. He will rescue his people. He'll right the wrong of this world. the question is not, will God prevail? But the question is, will you be part of the team? Had Esther remained silent, she would have missed the opportunity to save thousands upon thousands of her kin. God would have delivered his children through someone else, but as Mordecai cautioned, relief and for the Jews and deliverance will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. Perhaps she hoped that this turmoil would pass her by. She may have considered silencing Mordecai. She was the queen, after all, and her Jewish ancestry was still a secret. Isolation was a sure temptation to her. Yet Mordecai had cautioned strongly against it, and inaction would have been costly. Esther's name and the name of her family would have become words for apathy. Well, what about you and me? We can retreat if we want and let our hearts grow cold or our faith grow cold, hibernate, hide out, go dark like we do on Halloween, stay quiet, or we can see our challenges as an opportunity to join God in his work. Listen, each one of our lives intersects with opportunities in which we can come alongside the work of God. Heaven will offer each one of us, without exception, the privilege of participating in holy work. And when your invitation comes, may you hear the same spirit that Mordecai heard. May you find the same courage that Esther found. May you listen to the voice of your shepherd. May God help you and me to be a part of it. As we conclude this week's journey, let Stephen Curtis Chapman's words from Miracle of the Moment just resonate in your soul toward all you face. There's only one who knows what's really out there waiting in all the moments yet to be. And all we need to know is that he is out there waiting. To him, the future's history, and he has given us a treasure called right now. And this is the only moment we can do anything about. And if it brings you tears, then taste them as they fall. Let them soften your heart. And if it brings you laughter, then throw your head back and let it go, let it go. You gotta let it go. Listen to your heartbeat. There's a wonder in the here and now. It's right there in front of you. And I don't want you to miss the miracle of the moment. In these moments, we need to remember who we are, and we need to remember whose we are. Our challenge and our mission day by day is to bear his image. Our charge is found in Ephesians 5, verses 1 and 2. Be imitators of God in everything you do, for then you will represent your Father as his beloved sons and daughters, and continue to walk surrendered to the extravagant love of Christ, for he surrendered his life as a sacrifice for us. His great love for us was pleasing to God, like an aroma of adoration, a sweet, healing fragrance. Selah.